Hi everyone, this is Tosh, and today Jimmy and I are speaking with author András Körner, who is a leading expert on Jewish culture and food. András has a fascinating life story. He was born in 1940. As a child, he survived the Holocaust in Budapest Jewish ghetto. He later fled communist Hungary and went to New York City, where he worked as an architect. And over time, András became interested in his family's Jewish past, about which he knew almost nothing. So fast forward to today, András has written 8 excellent books, including How They Lived, Hogyan Éltek in Hungarian, which is a cultural history of Jewish people in Hungary from the beginning of the Austro-Hungarian Empire to World War II. And he also wrote Jewish Cuisine in Hungary, A Magyar Zsidó Konyha, which won a National Jewish Book Award.
Hi guys, this is Jimmy. Tosh is currently visiting New York City, where I live myself, and we recorded this conversation with András on the roof of his Upper West Side apartment. Given the COVID situation, we decided to interview him outdoors, so please forgive the occasional gust of wind or police siren. The cold weather didn't stop us from enjoying the conversation with András, who is 81 and still enviably sharp. He tells us about everything from the golden era of Jews in Budapest to the origins of pastrami and cholent. We hope you enjoy it as much as we did.
András, I suggest we begin with your background. Can you please introduce yourself to the audience?
I'm an architect by training, but when I retired from architecture at age 63 or 64, I decided to devote my time mainly to writing books and organizing exhibitions, not exclusively, but mostly about the lifestyles and cuisine of Hungarian Jews. Before the Holocaust, not the current one.
Yeah, and I mean today you're most known for your many of the wonderful books you've written about Jewish culture and Jewish food in Hungary. But how did that interest in Judaism develop for you?
Well, it developed very late. I mean, I was conscious of being of Jewish origin, though strictly speaking, I am a Lutheran, and because we converted in 1944 in the hope that that would save us from some of the bigger trouble. It didn't save us from the bigger trouble, but nevertheless, since I'm not religious, I'm an atheist, and I never bothered reconverting, and I remained, I guess, officially today I'm still a Lutheran, but in reality I'm Jewish. And I really did not much care about religion or my Jewish background up until around age 50. I started recording my mother's life, doing an oral history with her, and I discovered that the family's Jewish background, which I thought was in the distant past and I have very little to do with it, is actually not so distant. And although my parents were also atheists, my grandmother was already half religious, and my great-grandparents were strictly Orthodox, not Orthodox, but kept kosher, and they were quite religious.
So what was your experience growing up? What sort of experiences did you have firsthand with Hungarian Jewish food, and were there any dishes that you had a real personal connection to?
I had probably zero connection to it because my family did not keep kosher. We ate everything, pork and everything you can imagine that is not Jewish. And honestly, because I grew up in this secular Jewish family, instinctively I somehow try to keep my distance from my Jewish background and the Jewish background of the family. All the girls I went out with were Christian, and I somehow kept my distance, and not as a conscious decision, more instinctively. I sort of felt that I don't want to get into this social ghetto, and I wanted to get away from it. And I got interested when I started recording my mother's oral history, and because she had all these memories about the Jewish background of the family, I got interested to try to figure out what they mean, what how they came about, and I tried to read up on it, and gradually I was drawn into it.
Background that, that you said, you know, you grew up in a highly assimilated household. I know from one of your books that you even celebrated Christmas, for example.
Oh, very much so.
Was this a common thing in Budapest at that time?
Yes, I mean, look, about 90% of my parents' friends and acquaintances, they were assimilated Jews, but none of them were religious, or practically speaking, none of them, and certainly none of them were Orthodox. And many of them, and that was quite typical of Budapest assimilated Jews, that they kept Christmas and Easter as secular holidays. And we did too. And in fact, one of my few memories from the ghetto where I had the pleasure being in late 1944 and the first days of 1945. That happened to be the time when there was Christmas in December, and we celebrated Christmas in the ghetto. And we were not the only ones to celebrate Christmas in the ghetto.
That's incredible. In terms of just, you know, we don't have to get into all of it, but. About your recollections from those years that leading up to the Second World War, sort of how should we imagine this ghetto and what was it like being there?
I was very small, and my real memories are really vague recollections, and practically speaking, I have no memories or only the vaguest of vague memories. I mean, I sort of recall that in the so-called protected house where we were before taking to the ghetto, we had to sleep on the floor because it was so crowded, lots of families had to share a room, and we were sleeping on mattresses placed next to each other on the floor, and in the ghetto too. And I sort of vaguely remember when they brought around food in the ghetto, but really I have very few memories of the ghetto. I have lots of memories immediately after the war, when the first weeks and months after returning from the ghetto, and I remember my mother coming back from concentration camp, and I could not remember her. I did not recognize her, and not because she was looking so badly or she was in such horrible shape, but because she was away for 6 months, or almost 6 months, and for a small child 6 months is like eternity, and I just did not recognize her initially. And I also remember going back from the ghetto to our former place, and so I have more memories from the first few weeks and months after the war, but very few from the ghetto itself.
Yeah, I would like to come back to this, but I think it would be interesting to hear for listeners just a little bit of background in terms of how Jewish life in Hungary was in the 19th century. And you actually wrote a wonderful book about this, How They Lived, or Hogyan Éltek, mm-hmm. which is just sort of makes even more striking what happened in Hungary during the Holocaust, because as I understand, there was a very sort of mutually beneficial coexistence in Hungary for a long time between Jewish people and the Christian population.
Yes, and for example, my great-grandmother, who grew up in the 1860s in Győr, in Western Hungary, in Northwestern Hungary, and she had lots of Christian friends, and she socialized with Christians, notwithstanding that she was highly religious, and they kept a kosher household, and they celebrated all the Jewish holidays. But she had Christian friends, she went to balls organized by Christians, and she participated in amateur theater performances where she was one of only two Jews, and almost all the participants were Christian. And I have her letters, I have 80 letters from her from the 1870s, practically all the letters that she wrote in the 1870s, so I can reconstruct her life practically day by day. And there is not a word of mention about anti-Semitism or anything, which does not necessarily mean that it was a general experience and it was everywhere exactly the same way, but it could not have been so totally atypical, and at least it was true for her in North Western Hungary.
And why did what was the reason that so many Jewish people came to Hungary at the time? I know in Budapest about a quarter of the population was Jewish, and also in the countryside many cities had double-digit Jewish residents.
Yeah. Well, look, it was not totally singular to the Jews. As you know, during the Ottoman occupation of Hungary, Hungary was by and large populated people. As they had to move abroad, they were killed. And after the Ottoman occupation ended, there was a real problem of who would take care of the country, who would do the work. And so they invited people from all over, and lots of German people and Serbians and Romanians and Slovakians and Czechs and you name it, they came to Hungary. And so you have to see this, the Jewish immigration, as part of it. And it had its own peculiarities, the Jewish immigration, but nevertheless it was not a totally unique thing in Hungary.
And what were, you know, in sort of what industries were Jewish people actively involved, you know, what sort of, how should we imagine their lives in Hungary?
Well, the difference was that Jews, because of their culture, they were highly literate people. I mean, they might have been very simple people, but they had to be able to read the Bible, at least men. I mean, that was not 100% true for women, but at least men, they had to study it, and they could read and write at the same time when literacy and their culture and tradition of studying, mind you, studying the Torah and studying the Jewish Bible. But nevertheless, this regular studying and literacy that predisposed them to certain professions, more so than, say, farmers who very frequently were illiterate and just did not have this sort of background. And so they became, particularly in the late 19th century, more and more active and in certain intellectual professions, like and also in to be merchants. I mean, a very large percentage of merchants in Hungary were Jewish, for one thing, because Jews were prohibited from certain professions, and also their literacy and also their knowledge of several languages, which was very typical of Jews, predisposed them toward these professions. And so about 60% of the merchants in Hungary were of Jewish background.
And I think there's also for doctors and lawyers.
And yes, later on. I mean, I think the merchants that was an earlier period, and then it survived to later on. But when it became possible for Jews to enter universities, first the physicians could be Jewish, going back quite some time. It was one of the traditional occupations. But in other professions like law and legal professions and engineering and you name it, that was not possible before the very end of the 19th century. But again, because of this tradition of literacy and sort of studying that predisposed them for these professions, and also they became very active in not only in trade, but also in certain manufacturing fields, because the Hungarian middle class, the ethnic Hungarian middle class, and particularly the nobility, and in Hungary there were nobility, you don't have to imagine that they were all aristocrats and filthy rich, but there was a lower nobility also, but it was not really accepted and was not really good behavior for a lower nobleman to be a factory owner. I mean, they could be the judge, they could be the notary, they could be the mayor of a city, but to be a factory owner, that was not comme-il-faut.
To wake up at 8 o'clock was not their thing.
And so it happened that, just to give you a bizarre example, and I'm sure you know this, that the two largest pork salami factories in Hungary, they were both owned by Jewish families, because it would have been unimaginable that a Christian middle class person, or mind you, a lower nobility person, and there were lots of such people of lower ranking nobility, noble families, which were not rich, but they sort of kept count of their noble background, that they would lead a pork salami factory. I mean, that would have been just unimaginable. But for the Jews who could not eat pork, to run a factory that produces pork salami and make a living out of that was perfectly normal. I mean, why not? What's wrong with it?
Yeah, and I mean, this is the assimilated Jews that you're mentioning, you know, who are willing to have, you know, businesses and you know, I think they also started, you know, the assimilation took many forms, right? For instance, they, I think, stopped wearing the sort of the Orthodox sort of black robes, and started speaking Hungarian rather than Yiddish. What were sort of the these manifestations?
In manufacturing, indeed, the assimilated was dominant, though not exclusively. I mean, there were Orthodox manufacturers, for example, the Freudenthals in Budapest, they were the largest manufacturers, I believe, of underwear and various things, and they were Orthodox. But the assimilated fitted easier into these roles, because they had to deal with other merchants who were not necessarily Jewish, and also they could keep working on Saturdays too, and while if somebody was an Orthodox then could not work, so there were lots of problems. But among the merchants, there were lots of Orthodox. I mean, among the merchants, it was not necessarily true that all the merchants were assimilated.
Okay.
No.
Interesting. Okay, sort of moving on in time, you know, the Austro-Hungarian Empire is thriving coexistence, and then we have the First World War, when the Austro-Hungarian Empire crumbles and, you know, falls apart. And then Hungary, sort of doing a 180, became one of the first countries in Europe, I believe, which implemented anti-Jewish laws.
It was the first. Yes, it was the first. The numerus clausus, which limited the percentage of Jews who can be accepted for universities. And the reason for this is related to the end of World War I, which Hungary, as a result of the peace treaty ending World War I, lost two-thirds of its territory, and lots of people, particularly middle-class people, from those lost territories, they streamed and moved to Hungary, and all of a sudden they wanted to find work. And they saw all these Jews who were doctors and lawyers and in various other intellectual professions. And they said, how come, you know, I mean, we should be able to get these positions too. And And that was the time when the numerus clausus was introduced. And that was very drastic because in certain professions there was a very large percentage of Jews, and all of a sudden that had to be cut back to a fraction of it. Lots of younger Jewish people had to study abroad, including on my mother's side an aunt who had to study medicine in Vienna, and then on my father's side an uncle who had to study dentistry in Italy, and lots of talented people, exceptionally talented people, had to move abroad, initially to mainly to Germany, interestingly, and then later on from Germany to other places. And so Hungary lost a huge number of great talents. Many of them later received Nobel Prize and became highly prized physicists and mathematicians and so on and so forth.
Can you give a couple of names for
us? Like von Neumann, who was instrumental in establishing the theory for early computers, or Teller, who was instrumental in some of the nuclear bombs and research, and Szilard, who was also very, in the Manhattan Project there were lots of people of Hungarian background, and almost invariably they were Jewish, and people who had to leave exactly because of the numerous clauses. And so one of them, I think Jenő Wigner, mentioned that in a paradoxical way he would have never had such a big career had he remained in Hungary then because he had to leave because of the numerous clauses, and he had far greater possibilities than he would have had in Hungary.
Yeah. And I think it's also true for Janos Neumann, John von Neumann,
yes,
who many people consider to be the smartest man who's ever lived.
Exactly.
And I think Marcel Breuer, just to pick another field.
Yeah, who I knew personally, yes, indeed. I mean, Breuer tried to move back to Hungary in the 1930s, when in Germany it became really very difficult. And in Hungary, because he was he did not have a university degree in architecture, but he studied at the Bauhaus, and he was without doubt the most famous architect Hungary ever produced. But he was not accepted into the Hungarian, I think, Engineering League or whatever was the name, I don't remember the exact name. And without that, he could not practice architecture in Hungary. So he spent like a year or two in Hungary, and eventually had enough of it and left, and that was that.
Then, you know, we're going up to the Holocaust. I think, you know, most people know the history of the Holocaust. We don't have to get into that now. That basically almost everyone, every Jewish people from the Hungarian countryside, I think about more than, I think, 437,000 people were deported from Hungary, mainly to Auschwitz, and most of them perished. But Jewish people in Budapest, including yourself, were taken into a ghetto, but most of them survived.
Well, about, I believe, a little bit more than half or two-thirds of them survived. I mean, it's still, the attrition was pretty big in Budapest too, but I mean, I don't remember the exact numbers, but nevertheless, by no means all of them. But what happened is that Budapest Jewry was so central to production, including war production, and including stuff that was supplied to Germany for the war effort, that they left the question of what to do with the Jewry in Budapest to the end. And by the time it came up in June 1944, there was the Normandy invasion, And Horthy, who was, according to his own admission, was an anti-Semite, and he had been an anti-Semite all his life.
This is Miklos Horthy, who was the governor and the head of Hungary between the World Wars,
and the governor of Hungary, but he could see the writing on the wall, and after the June 1944 Normandy invasion, he decided in July 1944 to stop the deportation. And that was not because he was all of a sudden became so friendly toward the Jews, but he could see that eventually accounting might come and things might not work out quite the way it looked a few years earlier. And as a result, he decided to stop the deportation. But of course, then there was the Arrow Cross, which was like an extremist, basically like a Nazi type organization, though it was a homegrown organization. They took over and they murdered lots of Jews because they were like total lawlessness, and people were marauding on the streets, and it was beyond control. But nevertheless, far, far more Jews survived in Budapest than in the countryside.
And so maybe just thinking about the present day, so how much of this community is intact in Budapest today? And you know, what's been the experience? Obviously, for a visitor, there's mm-hmm. been a huge amount of change mm-hmm. in the, you know, that part of the city. It looks very different visually. Mm-hmm. How many of those people are still there?
Uh-huh. Well, I believe Hungary has one of the largest Jewish population today. That is so to speak homegrown, as opposed to Germany, where a very large number or percentage or share of the Jewish population in Germany today, it came relatively recently from other countries, and very few Jews in Germany have really German background and family background. And in Hungary, virtually all Hungarian Jews have Hungarian backgrounds, and it's disputed because there are no reliable statistics how big the Jewish community is, but it's quite substantial, and certainly one of the biggest, and possibly I think the biggest in Europe. But I think if you speak of homegrown population and not recent immigrant population,
but I think we should add to that this is, they're essentially all in Budapest, and they're almost all of them are highly, highly assimilated Jewish people.
Yes.
Many of them don't even know, perhaps, that they have Jewish ancestry, because the more Orthodox Jews used to live in the Hungarian countryside, and those few of them survived. Yeah. And the ones who survived, many of them left the country. In fact, just not far from where we are in Brooklyn, there's the Hasidic Orthodox community, the Satmars, which mm-hmm. originates from mm-hmm. a formerly Hungarian town. Just one last thing I would like to ask you before we move over to the Jewish food side of things, which is that after the Second World War, you know, the Soviet Union, liberated the ghetto, and then very soon after they instituted a communist system, and many members of this political system, especially in the 1950s, the Rákosi regime, were Jewish, and so there's this idea that even today you can hear, you know, people say that, well, you know, the communist regime was very much pro Jew, since, you know, almost all of them constituted of Jewish people. So why was it that there were so many Jewish people in the communist leadership, and what was their approach towards the Jews?
Well, the reason why there were so many Jews among communists was very simple, that Jews were suppressed, persecuted, excluded from universities, you name it, and then even before the German occupation, but then came the Holocaust. And it was natural that they were driven into social groups or opposition groups that opposed that system that persecuted the Jews. So it was not some mystical connection, but very specific historical reasons. But the Jews who then ruled during the communist system, or particularly the initial part of the communist system, you have to distinguish between before 1956 and after 1956. After 1956, there were very, very few Jews actually in the government. But before, indeed, there were lots of them. But they considered themselves communist, and they strenuously argued that their identity was not Jewish. And in fact, they really tried to suppress Jewish identity or any sign of Jewish identity as best as they could. And in fact, there were some pogroms even immediately after the war. And it was a historical confluence, while there were lots of rulers in the early parts of the communist dictatorship were Jewish, but they certainly did not act like Jews, and in fact they tried to suppress Jewish identity and any sort of Jewish group movement in Hungary as best as they could.
So it's more of a misconception that, and you know, I know there are many sort of wealthier Jewish families who were evicted from their homes and how
very much
during
so.
The communist system. Okay, let's move over to the Jewish food side. You know, you are an expert on not just Jewish food in Hungary, but I think Jewish food in general. And your 2019 book, the Jewish Cuisine in Hungary, won a National Jewish Book Award. So my first question was sort of, it's hard to, you know, Jewish people have lived essentially all across the world, and is it even possible to define what Jewish food is?
Yes, Jewish food, what Jews eat, to put it very simply. And you know, this sounds like flippant or glib, but it is true. I mean, whether it was originally or you going back centuries, it was Jewish or adopted from other cuisines, it's secondary. If they eat it, it's Jewish food, and that's it. I mean, in some ways, as much of Hungarian food is not Hungarian, if you strictly speak, it has absolutely nothing to do with other countries. Of course it has to do with other countries. It was adopted from various other cuisines and it became Hungarian food. So what is Hungarian food? What Hungarians eat, that's Hungarian food. And what is Jewish food? What Jews eat is Jewish food.
Okay, fair enough. Then going at it a little differently, perhaps, I think many people, when think of, you know, Jewish food, they think of the kosher rules. For instance, you know, Jewish people don't eat pork, or Jewish people don't mix the ones who are kosher meat and milk dishes. What was the reason for these rules? Was it for health reasons? Was it because the Torah? And instead of, what's the origin of these?
There were some theories, and even to this day, there are some people who maintain that there were health reasons. It might be partially true, though I seriously doubt. My opinion is that the real reason was simply to preserve identity and group cohesion. And it was based on various traditions, and then later on, very frequently, these traditions were exaggerated and made much stricter, exactly in order to preserve cohesion. And Jews, because of the diaspora, they were scattered all over the world, and it was a real issue how they can survive as a ethnic or religious cohesive group, and certainly kashrut helped.
And what is the kashrut?
Kashrut is the rules of how to keep kosher. Basically, it's a group of rules. Kosher is simply an adjective. Something is acceptable. In fact, that's the meaning of the word. That's kosher, but it's an adjective. And kashrut is a group of rules which is necessary to keep kosher.
And so can you maybe talk a bit about the experience of Hungarian food, of Jewish food in Hungary, and what's unique about Jewish food there? Are there different ingredients? Are there things about the specific tradition of Hungary that's different that influence the progression of the food there?
Well, there is very little that is unique. I mean, what is unique or halfway unique is what they borrowed from the non-Jewish food. And Jewish food always, on one hand, was quite conservative and kept certain traditions and certain ideas for food from way back, some of them going back to biblical times. But at the same time, it was like a sponge absorbing all these influences and then converting them not only adopting them, but adopting them and revising them. And that was true also in Hungary. So it's difficult to say that so much of Hungarian Jewish food is uniquely Hungarian. No, it is not. But because Hungary is part of the Ashkenazi culture, and Sephardic culture has very little presence in Hungarian Jewish culture, and specifically culinary culture, for one thing, Hungarian Jewish food is almost completely, not entirely, but almost completely an Ashkenazi type of Jewish food. What is the difference between Ashkenazi Jewish food and Sephardic Jewish food? To really simplify it, it's not like the full truth, but one can say that Ashkenazi culture and Ashkenazi culinary culture is a cold climate culture, and it was originally it evolved originally in sort of the borderline between Germany and France, and then later on, when Jews were expelled from France, from England, from Germany, then many of the Jews in the Middle Ages, they moved east and moved to Poland, and then later on Poland, some part of Poland was then absorbed into Russia, and then to Russia and the rest of Eastern Europe. And they carried this Ashkenazi culture with them, while the Sephardic culture, strictly speaking, Sephardic culture is the Jews who have Spanish and Portuguese roots, but later on it spread to the Near East and even parts of Africa and certainly Southern Europe. So again, it is the same way as Ashkenazi is not just the borderline between France and Germany, the same way as Sephardic culture is not just Spanish and Portuguese. But the Sephardic culture is essentially a Mediterranean culture, and where Mediterranean food stuff dominates, like olive oil and tomatoes and zucchini and saltwater fish, while in Ashkenazi culinary culture, it's mainly like goose fat and chicken fat instead of olive oil, and mainly like root vegetables that survive easier in cold climate, and mainly sweetwater fish, except for herring, because salt herring could be transported without refrigeration even back in centuries ago quite easily inland, and because herring is a relatively cheap fish, and even in far away from the sea, it was quite cheap, sometimes even cheaper than sweetwater fish.
To me, this was fascinating when I was reading in your book, that which is what you're explaining, is that many of the sort of quintessentially Jewish dishes, Ashkenazi Jewish dishes that we think of, for instance, you know, pastrami or the challah bread or the bagel, are in some ways variations that came from the mainstream cultures where Jewish people lived. Maybe I'm simplifying it, but could you perhaps confirm this or give some other examples?
You asked before what is unique in Jewish food in Hungary. And certain foods that in America, when you ask somebody and immediately associates with Jewish food, like pastrami, like gefilte fish, that is practically unknown in Hungary. I mean, gefilte fish is known in Eastern Hungary because it was essentially an import or a part of the Yiddish-speaking culture that dominated in easternmost Hungary. But for example, my ancestors and in Western Hungary, gefilte fish was practically unknown up until recently. And pastrami, I don't believe is known in Hungary except for possibly now when it's an American or foreign influence. But pastrami, it goes, the word actually has Turkish origin. It's called pastrami or something like that, and it means pressed. It comes from the Turkish word to press, and in original form it was one way of meat preservation where they tried to press all the moisture out of the meat, and it was sort of like jerky, this really dry meat. And that was also known in Romania, but what we know in the United States as pastrami, that has absolutely nothing to do with Romania. It's an American invention from the late 19th century, and it's basically something fairly related to corned beef. I mean, it's some related form of preparing beef, and it was invented and popularized by American Jews, but it has certainly nothing to do with Romania, and it has nothing to do with European heritage. It's actually a New York invention. It's not even, when I say American invention, I have to even narrow it down to a New York invention, because it's specifically late 19th century New York.
Okay, but this can't be said for the matzo ball soup or the bagel. Those do have origins in Europe, am I right?
Yes, yes. No, and look, matzo, again, that goes back to way back, that in order to celebrate Pesach, Passover. Passover, the Jewish Easter, or however you want to call it, that one cannot eat anything that could ferment, and you cannot eat anything that uses yeast and could be fermented, and therefore you eat this basically like a cracker type stuff that is made from special flour that is kept especially dry, that no moisture can get to it and ferment, and even that was complicated. And that leads to a thing that I want to emphasize, that even within Orthodoxy, it's not one size fits all. Because while there were like common features what Orthodox followed and believed, like some of the Orthodox, they could eat matzah ball at Passover and at Seder, which starts the Passover period, the Pesach period. And some other Orthodox, they would not eat matzah balls because they said that possibly some parts of the matzah was not perfectly baked, and some flour could remain there in the matzah, and when it gets moist, get wet, when it's moistened in the matzah ball, then it might ferment, and that's totally unacceptable. So there were some Orthodox, particularly those who came from Galicia and mainly Hasidim, but not only Hasidim, they refused to eat matzo balls during Passover because they said, well, it could ferment and it's not acceptable. And other Orthodox were perfectly happy to eat it. And so it's not one size fits all.
So if you were to recommend, you know, some of the people listening to this, maybe planning a trip to Budapest or elsewhere in Hungary, if you were to recommend, you know, a couple of dishes that you could find in Budapest that you think would be kind of the most characteristic Jewish food that you could find today, you know, what would you recommend people seek out and try?
Well, certainly matzo ball soup. Certainly, there were a few things that are actually Hungarian inventions. Particularly, that there are two pastries that are Hungarian inventions. One is called flódni, and the other is called kindli. Flódni is much better known than kindli. They are actually related pastries. They are all exist in. They are stuffed with ground poppy seeds and ground walnuts. In kindli, there are two versions. One is stuffed with poppy seeds, the other is stuffed with ground walnuts. In flódni, it's all combined and it's like a multi-layer pastry with four or five layers of ground poppy seeds and ground walnuts and then chopped apples and chopped and stewed apples and plum butter and those are just about the only things that I could say that they are Hungarian inventions. They probably were created in the late 19th century. Nobody knows exactly when. Probably in Budapest, though it's difficult to say it with certainty. And even flódni is not totally out of the blue and unrelated, because it's a close variant of the Fehér torta, which is a Viennese torta, which has similarly layers and it's also like several different fillings. And actually, the name flódni, it comes from the old medieval Jewish and actually non-Jewish pastry, and it's called fladen, which is basically fladen. It comes from a Latin word which is related to the English word flat and the German word flach. And basically it's a filled flat pastry where you have some sort of a filling between two layers of pastry. And the flódni, which clearly the name is related to this medieval fladen, it's the same idea, but it's sort of it carries it to decadence, where it's not just one filling, but four different fillings and five layers of dough, but it's basically the same idea.
And what's your personal favorite?
Well, I love flódni. I like matzo ball soup. I like herring. I very much like herring, though it's actually not very common these days in Hungary, because earlier in the 19th century and earlier 20th century, salt herring was commonly imported into Hungary. It's no longer imported, and so you can get in jars some sort of herring imported from Poland and from Germany. But generally, it's not so easy to get herring these days in Hungary as it used to be.
I would like to ask you a question about fish, but just before that, a quick recommendations for the listeners. In Budapest, there's a girl, her name is, I believe, Vámos Juci, and she's using her grandmother's flódni recipe, mm-hmm. and they're wonderful. They're one of my favorite pastries. in Hungary, and I know she delivers to many of the many restaurants in Budapest, including to Rosenstein, which is probably the most famous Jewish Hungarian restaurant in Budapest, and they make many of these dishes, you know, cholent or cholent. They make matzo ball soup, and they actually order their flodny from Jutsi, and it's delicious. Okay, so in your book you mention that fish in all different variations and permutations is very common to Jewish food across the world, or more or less across the world. Why is that?
It has actually religious reasons. Is that Jews also hope that the arrival of the Messiah and the arrival of the Messianic age, and according to Jewish biblical tradition, the sea monster, the Leviathan, which is not exactly a fish but something vaguely resembling some sort of a sea animal, that will announce the arrival of the Messianic age. Now, it's all sort of a complicated story, but bear with me, that the Shabbat supposed to give you a foretaste of the Messianic age, because that's the end of the week and everybody is happy and is eating better than usual food, and so that gives you a foretaste of the Messianic age. And as a result, at the arrival of the Shabbat, Friday night, and also when other holidays and festivals come in, then it's traditional to eat fish, because it's sort of part of this symbolic connection to the Messianic age. And as a result, traditional Jewish food and Jewish culinary culture, fish plays an important role, and particularly these days when in Hungary has one of the lowest fish consumptions in Europe, but that's totally not true for Jewish food, where it's a relatively important part. And in fact, if when you look at Jewish cookbooks, you will find almost as many fish recipes in a typical Jewish cookbook as, say, poultry recipes. And typically in Hungarian cookbooks, you will find far, far more poultry recipes than fish recipes.
Interesting.
But that actually is something interesting which deserves mention, that the book I wrote about Hungarian Jewish cuisine, I called it Cultural History, because I was interested in food as part of a culinary culture, and not just dishes and recipes, but a broader culture, because I strongly believe that food is a highly important part of any culture and should be examined as a cultural phenomenon, not just nice or not so nice recipes, because it's so important for any culture, including Jewish culture, and Jewish culture particularly, because so many of the holidays have very specific food traditions, more so than in Christian religion. I mean, say, think of it how the weekend goes in a religious Catholic or Christian family, that say Friday evening they might eat fish because that's traditional, and say Sunday they have a nicer dinner because that's traditional, but that's more or less the end of it. But in Jewish tradition, there is like a whole long, long list of traditions that you have to observe, and various meals, and it's an incredibly elaborately choreographed ritual, the Shabbat, far more so than the traditional Christian end of the week. And also just for the sheer fact of kashrut, food and religion is indispensable. It's closely related, and so that's why I decided to examine it in a cultural context and not just like a cookbook of nicer or not so nice recipes. But that takes me to a very interesting part of Hungarian Jewish tradition, that Hungary was the absolute forefront in the world in publishing Jewish cookbooks in the 19th century. Some of the most important early Jewish cookbooks were published in Hungary, including the world's first cookbook published in Hebrew letters, was published in 1854 in Pest, in Budapest. And the three countries that published the largest number of Jewish cookbooks in the 19th century were Germany, where the first Jewish cookbook was published in 1815, mind you, written by a Christian guy, a Catholic guy. And in England, where there were also lots of Jewish cookbooks published, and Hungary. And all the other countries, including Russia, where the largest Jewish population lived in the 19th century, orders of magnitude fewer cookbooks were published. And also in Holland, where there was a highly important Jewish community going back centuries, and including the United States, I mean.
And why, I mean, in your book, your new book, which as you just finished, the manuscript is coming out about this, and you know, we don't have to get into the weeds, but just it's sort of an interesting phenomenon, because there are other you know, countries in Europe at that time, there were big Jewish populations, for example, in Poland and in the U.S. by that time too. So how come you think that Hungary was at the forefront of this?
Again, it's a confluence of several reasons. One was that. Hungary had the second largest Jewish population in Europe at the time in the 19th century. That's not widely known, but Russia was, or the Russian Empire, which included at that time Lithuania and included Poland, that has by orders of magnitude the largest number of Jews. But Hungary was second after Russia, the Russian Empire. And the difference was very big. I mean, in Russia in the late 19th century, there were more than 5 million Jews, and in Hungary only like 850,000. So, I mean, it's, mind you, second is second by a huge difference, but nevertheless second. So that was one reason. The other reason was that all these early cookbooks were published in German, because German was a Kultursprache, that was... And cookbooks were printed for the middle class. I mean, poor people would not buy cookbooks. And the middle class Jews, both in Hungary and in Germany and all over Europe, actually, they were to a very large extent German speaking. If German was not their first language, then it was their second language. In any case, they could read German. So all these initial early Jewish cookbooks were printed in German, and that made it possible to export them and advertise them abroad, so that provided a market for them. And the other reason was that not only the Hungarian Jews were large in number, as I said, were second largest, but had a higher percentage of middle-class Jews than in Russia, and certainly in Poland. For example, Budapest was the second largest Jewish city in Europe. I mean, the first was Warsaw, and Budapest was the second. And actually, even in numbers, the number of Jews in Budapest was not much behind Warsaw. But the huge difference was that Budapest had a much, much larger share of the Jews were middle class, who would buy cookbooks and who were interested in cooking, than in Warsaw, where a very substantial part were poor and they would not buy cookbooks. So there were it was a confluence of various reasons, but be as it may, it's a really an interesting footnote to the cultural history of Jewish food in Hungary, that Hungary was so much in the forefront of publishing Jewish cookbooks.
I would like to ask you about a specific dish that many people consider to be the essential dish for Shabbat, for Saturday lunch, which is the cholent, in Hungarian cholet. Can you tell us what it is and how it's made, and how do they make sure that it's kosher, and how did it evolve?
Well, cholent is one of the very, very few dishes that have some biblical roots. The Mishnah, which is a 3rd century compilation of rules, that says that the Shabbat dish, I think the word they use, tomnin et hahamin, and means that it should be kept warm and covered. And that's the essence of cholent. It's not the beans people imagine that cholent has to be made from beans. No, the essence is the cooking process, which means that it has to be prepared before and kept covered and warm for Shabbat. And therefore there were lots of different cholents. Cholent actually came, as best as we know, in the 12th or the 13th century from the Sephardic roots. It was carried to Provence, to southern France, and spread from there. And the word cholent, which is specific to France, it has a word has a French origin, and probably, though it's not absolutely sure, it has something to do with the word of warm, show, and the same way as actually the Sephardic name for cholent, which is hamin, it also has to do with warm. So that shows that because hamin is a Hebrew word for hot. And that shows that all this goes back to this ancient Mishnaic root of what the Shabbat dish is, and it has nothing to do with beans. And chalet, which was the French word, then spread all over Europe, at least in the Ashkenazi world, and became chalet and cholent and cholet, and there are all these variations which all go back to the Provençal southern French chalet. But there are peach cholents, there are chickpea cholent, there is even the various cholents. Though, indeed, the most common is made with beans.
Yeah, and in Hungary there is a bit of a renaissance, I think, about cholet and cholent. It's sort of coming back into the mainstream. Mm-hmm. There's a place in Budapest called a Séf utcája, where every Friday they serve. Mm-hmm. They have this fixed lunch menu, cholet for a main dish, followed by flódni. Mm-hmm. Afterwards. Okay, I think, did you have any questions about the food? If not, I would be very curious to know what you're currently working on now, András. How many books are still in the in your drawer that you're working on?
Well, I'm just finishing one, and I just a month ago I had to give a talk at a conference about I gave the title to my talk how to read a cookbook, which was sort of like a facetious title, but basically what I said that to read a cookbook, particularly an old cookbook and an early cookbook, one should read beyond the words and should try to research its social background and its history beyond the publishing history, but who the book was written for, and who used it, and what were the intentions with the book, and so on, and what influenced the book from you know, other Jewish cookbooks, and try to examine as much of the cultural background of it as possible. It goes back again to my very strong conviction that food is a cultural category, and it's far, far more than recipes and dishes. I mean, there's nothing wrong with recipes and dishes, but food as a subject of research, it goes much beyond dishes. And I'm considering writing an essay after I finished this current book, which is coming out both in Hungarian and in English, and which is about early Jewish cookbooks. I'm considering writing an essay about the earliest newspaper review of a Jewish cookbook in the world, probably in the world, which was published in 1840 by a Hungarian-born Austrian journalist and writer named Safir, and he was of Jewish background and actually grew up in a very orthodox family, but later on converted to Lutheran religion. But he retained his fondness for Jewish traditions nevertheless, and he wrote several essays and articles about Jewish food, and some of it probably about the early Jewish food in Hungary. And he wrote this review, in fact, of the first Jewish cookbook published in Hungary, that 1840 book published in Pressburg in Bratislava. And Safir in Vienna wrote a review of it, which, as far as I know, is the first newspaper review of a Jewish cookbook. And he also wrote several other essays and feuilletons, sort of like newspaper articles about Jewish food. And so it could be considered probably the earliest food writer about Jewish food. And I would like to write an essay about his food writing and his complicated relationship to Jewish tradition and assimilation. He himself, you know, he converted, so he clearly was an assimilated Jew, but he had really mixed feelings about assimilation. He felt that much of the assimilation is too drastic, and they are trying to cut all ties to their roots and tradition, and he had more than mixed feelings about it. He was a complicated guy, he has mixed feelings about everything.
But you're absolutely right about the fact that in some ways food oftentimes is the sort of, for many, you know, many friends of mine here in New York and even back home in Hungary who are Jewish but no longer, you know, practicing Jews, they still preserve and retain some aspects of Jewish culture when it comes to food. For instance, you know, maybe they don't eat you know, pork, or maybe they you know, celebrate Shabbat or some aspects of Shabbat. So it's still, food is very essential to Jewish people who are no longer practicing.
I think it's true for any culture that food is so closely related to culture and tradition that food memories are really imprinted deeply in people, and that's definitely true in Jewish culture. And even people who gave up kashrut and don't eat kosher food anymore, they frequently not only retained a fondness for Jewish foods, but interestingly, they had mixed feelings. Talking of mixed feelings about Safir's mixed feelings, that it was not uncommon, not only in the 19th century but also in the 20th century, that people who no longer eat kosher food, but they came from a religious family, they had real guilt feelings about giving up kashrut. And some of them, including a very good friend who died a few years ago here, a Hungarian guy, he came from an Orthodox family, but he was totally, he sort of kept two or three major holidays a year, but he certainly did not keep kosher, and he ate shrimp, and when we went out to eat to a restaurant, he usually ordered shrimp, but he would not eat pork. And he was a highly educated, highly intelligent guy, and I asked him that, what sense does it make to eat shrimp and not to eat pork? And he said that, well, somehow I feel that by not eating pork I keep some vestige of my tradition. And one of the greatest scholars of Jewish food culture and generally of Jewish culture, Barbara Kirschenblatt Gimblett, she says that it's like a culturally formed disgust that survives even after people cut all ties to kosher and kashrut and all that, that in not all the time, but in some people it survives this. You can call it guilt feeling, you can call it some sort of a culturally formed distaste, but it can survive, and it sort of again is like a cultural phenomenon which is an interesting thing to study as part of culinary culture.
Yeah. Andras, thank you very much for speaking to us. The one last thing I just want to say is that, you know, for me personally, I'm like probably most Hungarians. I, growing up, I knew almost nothing about Hungary's Jewish culture and Jewish history. Mm-hmm. I think it says a lot about the sort of standards of education currently in Hungary. And then when I first came across your book of Hogy Éltek, How They Lived, which was about, how Jewish people lived in Hungary, that was sort of an eye-opening experience for me, and it sort of led me down this path where I've read, actually not almost, but I know for a fact I read all of your books, and they are just the perfect combination of, you know, deeply researched and factual-based the facts with a very sort of anecdotal and enjoyable style. So I really I like them, and I think this just sort of even helps you understand not just Hungary's past but Hungary's present too. And I think there's this rich layer of history from Hungary's Jewish past that most people don't know and are and missing out a lot. And so I look forward to reading many more of those.
Yeah, thank you so much. As a non-Hungarian and non-Jew, I learned a lot. I appreciate the time.
Yeah, thank you for